When did Oliver Stone approach you?
Well, my connection with Oliver Stone began about 2 months after the publication of my book, Crossfire, The Plot to Kill Kennedy, which was in the fall of 1989, I believe. And I think basically what happened was is that Oliver Stone had already decided to do a movie on the Kennedy assassination, and I think that's because he had already done Platoon, which shows the American combat experience in Vietnam, and then Born on the 4th of July, which then showed the aftermath and what it was like on the civilian side during Vietnam. And I think he, being a Vietnam combat veteran, and he was intensely interested in why Vietnam, what led to all that, and why we do that. And I think that led him to the Kennedy assassination. So he had already decided to use Jim Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans, as a protagonist, because as Stone told me, one of the first times I ever met him was, he said, "I want you to understand, I'm not making a documentary, I'm making a movie." So he wanted a storyline, and he was going to use Kevin Costner as Jim Garrison. The problem was Garrison's book covered his perspective and the events of his prosecution of Clay Shaw in New Orleans, but it did not really get into the details of the assassination itself in Dealey Plaza. And my book, Crossfire, covered that in great detail with all the evidence and witnesses and theories and everything else. And so he had a former CIA station chief, John Stockwell, working for him. And Stockwell, as I understand later, that told him, "Hey, Jim Mars has a book out that covers all those details." And so the next thing I know, my agent had gotten a contact from Stone's people and wanted to know if the book was available as the basis for a movie. And, of course, we said yes, and that's how all that began.
Were you skeptical at all? Because obviously this is a big Hollywood studio movie, JFK. I mean,
right.
you wouldn't have thought that they would be brave enough to mount a film like this.
Well, yes, I had some trepidations. But here's the thing. I already had my contract. I already got my money. And so I was fully prepared to repudiate the movie if I thought they strayed too much from my conclusions and my beliefs about the truth behind the assassination. But interestingly enough, they didn't even just use the material in my book per se. He had his own research team headed by a woman named Jane Rusconi, and they backtracked on my book, and they re-interviewed some of the same people I interviewed, and they looked at the same evidence I'd looked at, and interestingly enough, they came to the same conclusions.
Yeah.
And because it's just there, okay?
Yeah.
Let me explain to you about the Kennedy assassination in a nutshell. It's a matter of just belief systems, okay? If you trust the government and believe what the government tells you, even though they've lied to us time after time after time, I mean, light in the end of the tunnel of Vietnam, no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, read my lips, no new taxes, the air quality's okay on Manhattan following 9/11. I mean, they only lie to you continually. But if you trust the government, then you trust the evidence they present against Lee Harvey Oswald, and it does appear on the surface that it's pretty damning, and therefore he must have done it all by himself. But if you don't trust the government and you question this evidence and you look closer, it all begins to fall apart, and you realize that there's something else going on, and this is the key to the assassination. Anyone could have killed Kennedy. KGB agents, CIA assassins, mafia hitmen, Castro agents, and yes, even the proverbial lone nut. Okay, so anyone could have killed him, but who has the power to cover it up and to block any meaningful investigation and to fabricate evidence, destroy evidence, and alter evidence and suppress evidence and intimidate witnesses? Okay, only officials high in the federal government of the United States. And this is the key to the whole thing. This is what transformed what was then legally only another Texas homicide into a national coup d'etat. And that is the truth. And once you understand that, then everything kind of falls into place. It's like, you know, how, well, why is it still so controversial after 50 years? That's because nobody wants to admit to the coup of 1963.
And in that coup, in your opinion, what part, if any, did Oswald play?
He was a dupe, a patsy, just as he said he was. I think there's sufficient evidence to certainly raise reasonable doubt as to whether he even fired a rifle that day. Now, let me make this clear. I'm not saying Oswald was some innocent off the street. He was mixed up in the whole thing, but there is pretty overwhelming evidence that he was connected to U.S. intelligence, originally as through the Office of Naval Intelligence, and keep in mind the Marines are a branch of the Navy Department, picked up, sent on an intelligence mission to Russia, and then picked up as a CIA operative. There has been a CIA paymaster who testified to the House Select Committee on Assassinations that he actually remembered cutting checks from the CIA to Oswald long before the assassination. There's even an intriguing warning from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover in 1960. This is 3 years before the assassination, and he sent a memo to the Security Division of the State Department warning that an imposter might be using Lee Harvey Oswald's passport and seeking information. Now, that's amazing, because we were told at the time and basically throughout the years that nobody in the government knew much about Oswald. They didn't know him. They didn't know exactly what was going on. He was just kind of a loner. Nobody knew anything about him. And here shows none other than J. Edgar Hoover personally knew the name Lee Harvey Oswald 3 years before the assassination and suspected someone was impersonating him. It's just amazing. And so all of this adds up to the coup of 1963.
You know, Oswald, they wanted us to think of him as, like you said, the lone nut, just a frustrated loner. But his is really one of the most fascinating stories in American history. When you go down that wormhole, Oswald was much more than just your average lone nut out there with a rifle.
Right. When at the time of his death, he had just turned 24. So basically, you know, he was basically 23 years old. You know, what a young guy. And yet, in the year or two prior to the incident in Dallas, he was in contact with no less than 9 FBI agents. I ask you in your audience, how many FBI agents have you come into contact with over the past year or so?
Yeah. So just back to the movie very quickly. When you were... It was based upon your book in part, and you were also a consultant on the film, so I would imagine you were present for a lot of the shooting of the film. Were you present for the Dealey Plaza recreation?
Yes. Yes, I was. In fact, I had a role. They asked me if I wanted a part, and I said, well, I'm not that interested in a part. I said, but I would like to be on hand when you run the motorcade again, because having studied it all these years, that would really be a thrill to watch it all be reenacted. And so I shaved off my beard, and they put a toupee on me and some kind of outfit, and I was supposed to be Joseph Miltier, who was a right-winger here in Florida who had been tape-recorded by police several weeks ahead of time saying that Kennedy was going to be killed when he went to Dallas by sniper with a high-powered rifle. So I was there in the crowd along Houston Street when they ran the motorcade, and that was pretty interesting for me to watch it all, and having studied it at length as I have, and then watching it transpire in front of me. And while I'm there, I'll tell you about an incident that you probably hadn't heard about, but it kind of in a spiritual way tells me that I think there was probably somebody looking out for Stone in his movie. At one point, I was standing on the south curb of Elm Street and looking towards the school book depository in the intersection there at Houston and Elm. Moments before, a whole crowd of extras representing the crowd that day had been lined up all the way across the street because the street had been blocked off both then and at the recreation. And they had been curbing all through Houston Street there. But the day was hot, and they called a break and called cut. And all these extras had moved out of the street, which was in direct sunlight, and were all standing over in the shadow of the Texas School Book Depository to get out of the direct sunlight. Meanwhile, the sixth floor museum, which claims that they try to make no particular position on the assassination, and yet they plexiglassed off the sixth floor window and put the little boxes there and left the window half open, and you know, it just screams out, here's where the assassin was. And they wouldn't even let Stone film from that window. And I'll tell you the reason for that is because if you go and get in that window, which I have been there before they put the museum in, you cannot get a direct line of sight into the street where Kennedy was first shot because of an intervening tree. There's a live oak tree that's right there in between, and that causes a big problem. And, of course, they don't want people to see this because it contradicts the official version. And so they wouldn't let Stone film from the sixth floor window. But they allowed him to go to the seventh floor window, which was a really tall, big, tall plate glass window. And so I'm standing there watching this, and I look up, and there are on the seventh floor, and they're messing around at that window getting ready to shoot. Well, somebody must have bumped it or something, because all of a sudden this huge plate glass pops out of the window and starts falling down directly towards this crowd of extras standing there on the street corner. And I'm sitting there, and in my mind I'm flashing, this is horrendous. It's going to hit all those people, and it's going to shatter in a million pieces. And you're going to have all these people cut and maybe even killed. And just as I'm thinking that, a gust of wind came along and caught this pane of glass, and it kind of slid sideways and crashed into the middle of the street where they had just vacated and smashed into a million pieces. And wow. Everybody just kind of went, what was that, you know? And then people rushed out and began sweeping up the glass, and everything just went on, and I'm not sure that anybody even realized what kind of tragedy had just been averted. I think some of the people standing there below did not even realize what exactly had happened there. Isn't that an amazing story?
Yeah, that was that could definitely be construed as a sign. Tell me about what you were aware of in terms of the controversy surrounding this film and the efforts to kind of thwart the film before it even started shooting. I mean, this was unprecedented.
Well, here's the thing. I'm as a 50-year journalist, I try to maintain some objectivity, and so I certainly have no problem with dissenters and critics and people who want to say, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, and you know. But when I saw the high level of attack that took place on Stone's film, even before it was shown, I mean, any piece of art, whether it's a film or a statue or a painting or anything, you should at least let them perform and see the results and then criticize it, right? In this case, they were bitterly criticizing the film even before anyone got to see it.
Yeah.
In fact, there was someone purloined an early version of the script, like script number 2 or something like that, and passed it to someone in the media who got it to some of the national media attack dogs, and they were raising Cain about this early version of a script. Well, I can tell you, because I traveled to Dallas and would sit up in the Stoneleigh Hotel and go over the script, okay, and make notations and suggestions and criticisms and stuff, They ended up with, I think, the final shooting script was like script number 12. So they're attacking the movie on script draft number 2, and it wasn't even the final version. So that really told me that there was a conscious effort to try to denigrate this film even before anyone got to see it, which certainly tells me that there's an agenda there. This isn't just a issue of criticizing Stone and his work. This is an issue of trying to baffle and befuddle the public and keep them from paying any good attention to the film, which, by the way, was indeed a movie. So it's not 100% ground truth, but I'm here to tell you that the movie JFK is the closest we've come to hearing the truth about the Kennedy assassination.
I think so, too. And I know that Stone always said that it was his countermyth to the Warren Commission, but all of those hundreds of strands of information in JFK, I mean, there's a lot of truth to be grabbed amongst those strands, I think.
Absolutely. For example, I'm always being asked about, well, who was Mr. X, the person that Kevin Costner, as Jim Garrison, goes to Washington to meet, and he's some sort of insider, and he lays out all of the context in which the assassination took place. All right. The explanation for who was Mr. X basically was Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was a liaison officer between the Pentagon and the CIA, and as such, he was privy to information concerning both of those entities, and yet being a Pentagon officer, he had not signed the secrecy oaths that CIA officers are required to sign, and therefore he was able to actually talk and say what was going on. And Jim Garrison indeed met with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, but this was only years after the prosecution of Clay Shaw. It did not happen within the time frame of the movie. And so I think Stone quite correctly knew that if he identified the man that Kevin Costner met with as Colonel Prouty, he would be met with the debunkers who would say, well, that didn't happen. You know, it didn't happen at that time, and Stone's just making stuff up. So what he did was, actually, Jim Garrison did go to Washington, and he did meet with a military intelligence officer named Richard Case Nagel, and Nagel told him some information, inside information, about the assassination. So what happened here was Stone combined those two characters, Colonel Prouty and Richard Nagel.
Yeah, that's efficient filmmaking.
Became Mr. X.
I would imagine that you felt a certain kinship towards Jim Garrison. I mean, you guys were on the same journey and making lots of headway. I mean, did you have a lot of interaction with Mr. Garrison through the years?
Well, I wouldn't say a lot, but yes, I had met with him and interviewed him prior to even the movie deal going down. And I'd had lunch with him in New Orleans, and I found him to be a highly articulate and educated person, and a very fascinating background. A lot of people don't realize that he had been a forward artillery observer in World War II, flying a little plane, which is a very hazardous job because they'd shoot you down if they could. And then after the war, he joined the FBI. And a lot of people don't understand that he was an FBI agent for a while. Then he went on and got into politics and ran and was elected district attorney there in New Orleans, and in fact had earned some ire among the city fathers for his trying to clean up the judicial system and trying to make things a little better there. Now, he's been criticized because they said that he went soft on organized crime. Well, being district attorney of New Orleans, I would think would be pretty similar to being district attorney of Las Vegas, okay? the mob's there, the mafia's there. It's a fact of life, and you just have to deal with it, you know, as you can. But that doesn't mean that he was in the mafia's pocket. In fact, I asked him point blank about that at one point. I said, you know, they criticize you for talking about the CIA and the FBI, but you don't hammer on the mafia. And his explanation was that he believed that there was mafia involvement in the assassination. He said, and I agree with him, that they, however, they did not have the power to orchestrate something like this on their own, and certainly not the power to cover it up and prevent any future prosecutions against organized crime for assassinating the President of the United States. And he said, therefore, I'm not that interested in the mafia. I want to know who was behind it.
Absolutely. You know, I've been watching, obviously it's the 50th anniversary of the assassination, so there's a lot of television programming going on right now, and I've been watching a lot of it. And it feels to me, even though I'm sure the American public, through a vast majority, still believe in a conspiracy, it seems to me that the tide is starting to slowly turn to the lone gunman theory again in all of this stuff that I'm reading and watching on television. Do you sense that tide?
I absolutely do, and it's very simple. The powers that be, which are in power thanks to the coup of 1963, are trying to indoctrinate or at least confuse a whole new generation of Americans. You see, the cover-up in the Kennedy assassination has never been what we traditionally think of as a cover-up, a lack of evidence and information. The cover-up has been quite the opposite. It's been obfuscation, charge and countercharge, claim and counterclaim, theory versus another theory versus other theories, and they have confused the issue to the point where, as you point out, and it's obviously true, that 9 out of 10 Americans now believe that there was some sort of conspiracy to kill Kennedy, but everybody's confused and divided and fighting with each other over exactly which conspiracy it was, and that is the cover-up, because as long as the public is confused and conflicted, nothing gets done about it. And then you have to also understand that, you know, I am constantly asked, and have been for years, will we ever know the truth about the Kennedy assassination? And I'm here to tell you, yes, we know the truth right now. It's just that most people do not want to face it. And what I mean is that, yes, we had a national coup d'etat. John J. McCloy was one of the Warren Commission members. And during one of their early sessions, he made the statement. He said, what is the most paramount, what is of paramount importance is that we must show the world that the United States is not just another banana republic where the government can be changed through conspiracy. Okay? Well, unfortunately, yes, we are just another banana republic, and our government was changed through a conspiracy and through a violent act, which is the very definition of coup d'etat. And but so the real question becomes, will they ever tell us this truth? You know, will a federal official get up at a press conference and go, okay, here's what really happened? And the answer to that one is no, that's not going to happen. And I'll tell you why. Because to admit publicly that there was a coup in the United States in 1963 that put Lyndon Johnson into office would be to basically say that every seceding administration since Johnson has been illegitimate, okay? So you can imagine that lawyers would have a field day. They would go back and question every law, every regulation, every executive order, everything that's happened since 1963 could be called into question, all right, because we're just a banana republic. So nobody's going to admit that.
I discovered Buell Frazier. I had never really known about him before. And his story of taking Oswald to work that morning and him carrying a bag with him that he said was curtain rods, and that I'm sure the powers that be speculated was actually the rifle. What is your take on that?
I think they did more than speculate. I think they coerced Wesley Buell Frazier into telling this story about the curtain rods so they could explain how Oswald got a rifle into the school book depository. First off, consider this. Wesley Frazier had driven Oswald to work that morning, he could have been nailed as an accomplice in the assassination of the President of the United States. So they had a lot of leverage over Wesley, okay? So I think they got him to say whatever they wanted him to say. For one thing, if you go back and really study his testimony and that of his sister, you'll find that they said Oswald had this small package, and his sister said, they asked him what it was, and he said it was his lunch. They also not only stated but demonstrated that he tucked it up under his arm with one part of the package in under his armpit and the other cupped in his hand. Okay, that is entirely, you can't do that with the rifle, even the disassembled barrel of the rifle. It's too long. You couldn't do that. So obviously this package was not the rifle. Also, there were photographs taken of Oswald's room at the Beckley Street address that very weekend, once his name became known and he gained all the notoriety, and it shows that there's curtains hanging there in his room on curtain rods, and nobody ever turned up with the curtain rods, okay? Of course, they say it was a rifle, but then that gets to the question of the rifle, and the Warren Commission even hedged about the identity of the rifle. There's so much question about it. The people who originally found it, Deputy Sheriff Weitzman and Roger Craig and others, they said it was a 7.65 German Mauser, and they saw the word Mauser stamped on the receiver. And yet later that afternoon, it suddenly transformed into a 6.5 Mannlicher Carcano, an Italian war rifle. And then the Warren Commission published an ad from the magazine they said Oswald ordered the rifle from, and it showed a 42-inch rifle, long rifle, and it said this is an ad similar. Well, you know, even at the time I thought, well, wait a minute, why are they showing us a similar ad? You know, it was in American Rifleman, a national publication. Why don't they show us the actual ad? Well, the actual ad in the edition that he supposedly used to order the rifle shows a 46-inch long rifle. So instead of explaining this discrepancy, the Warren Commission chose to just show us a phony ad. So, and this was only the beginning. The Floyd Reby was the photographer who took the autopsy photographs of Kennedy, and Gerald Custer was the technician at Bethesda who took the x-rays of Kennedy's body. And both of them are now on the record. And keep in mind, these are the guys who took the x-rays and the photographs, not conspiracy theorists and not authors. And both of them are on the record now saying that the x-rays and photographs that the National Archives are presenting to the public are phonies, fakes, and not the ones they took. So there's been a massive cover-up at the level of the federal government, and this is what transformed what at that time was simply another Texas homicide into a national coup d'etat.
Another question that I had concerns Tippit. Oswald, several people said that they did see Oswald there at the scene of the murder.
Seen where?
They saw him empty out his shell casings, running away from the scene of the shooting of Tippit.
Well, yeah, but I would beg to differ with you. Nobody actually identified Oswald as being at the scene, except a lady named Helen Markham, but then she also said that she stooped down and talked with Officer Tippit as he was dying, which could not possibly be true because he was struck in the heart and he was dead before he hit the ground. And she also said other incoherent things, which kind of definitely calls her into question as a reliable witness. Some of the other people who saw the man running later were unable to identify Oswald in a police lineup. Warren Reynolds, for example, worked in a nearby used car lot, and he saw a man running past that they thought had been involved in the Tippit shooting, and so they brought him to City Hall, and they showed him the police lineup that Oswald was in, and he could not identify him. But a few weeks later, as he was getting off work, he was shot in the head, but he survived. And after that, now suddenly he could identify Oswald as being the man he saw running. So, see, the evidence falls apart once you look at it closely.
But how did they know Because Tippit knew to stop Oswald. How did they know who they were looking for within 15 minutes of the assassination?
Okay, this gets a little complicated, but you need to understand this. Lieutenant Jack Revel was the Dallas Police Intelligence Officer, and he testified that he rode back to police headquarters from the Book Depository Building with a military intelligence agent, Office of Naval Intelligence. And upon arriving back at the police station, first thing he did was type up a list of depository employees. Heading his list was Harvey Lee Oswald of 605 Elsbeth. Okay? Now, Lee Harvey Oswald had indeed lived at 602 Elsbeth in the fall of 1962, but that information was found nowhere on his employment applications or paperwork there at the Book Depository. So where did Revel get this erroneous name and erroneous address? Well, at the time of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, a Colonel Robert Jones of 4th Army Intelligence in Fort Sam Houston testified that he had some agents in Dallas and that on the day of the assassination, they contacted him and said that they had arrested a suspect in Dallas, and his name was Alex James Heidel. Jones said he went to military intelligence files and found a file on Alex James Heidel, and it cross-referenced to a Harvey Lee Oswald of 605 Elsbeth. So in other words, that tells us that the Dallas police were tipped off to the identity of their suspect by military intelligence. And I'll add one other thing, too. There was another Army intelligence agent named James Powell who made the mistake of going into the Texas School Book Depository, and then the police sealed the building. So he had to show his identification to get out, and he became part of the record. And we also have photographs that he took of the Book Depository building prior to the shooting. Now, you may ask yourself, why would a military intelligence agent be taking photographs of the School Book Depository prior to the shooting of President Kennedy, supposedly from that building? And it's a very good question, and it has never been answered.
Oh, my gosh. I could talk to you forever. I have one more question for you. This was the last point I was curious about. Of the actual photographs of the assassination and the video that day, obviously we all know Zapruder's film. Was there additional film taken that day that we have never seen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are hundreds of people in Dealey Plaza and all along the motorcade route, and hundreds, maybe even thousands of cameras and movie film. But you have to understand that at the time, you have to put it into context. 1963 Dallas was just a whole different time and place. They still had colored and white drinking fountains in public buildings. It was just a whole different time. And everyone, 63 was just coming. We were still coming off the glow of winning World War II. The government could do no wrong. If there was anything going wrong, if a monster was loose in your city, what do? You call the Army, right? Because the military was the great heroes, just as they're now trying to get everybody to go now. You know, all this stuff we just did for Veterans Day, it makes me ill because as an Army veteran myself, I know the disconnect between how that they publicly praise and laud the military, and yet if you are in the military, they screw you over pretty good. And there's a lot of vets that are really hurting. But anyway, so it was a different time and place, and everybody had unlimited faith and confidence in the government. And so right after the shooting on local TV, I know because I was here, local TV, local radio, and even in the newspapers, they ran big ads saying, asking people to turn in their film and their photographs and their negatives, you know, because they wanted the evidence to find out who killed our beloved leader. And everybody complied. Now, so people say, well, where's the evidence? Well, they took it all up. In fact, in the summer of 1964, You know, and months later, they were still putting out public appeals for people to turn in their photographs and films, and very precious few of any of those have ever seen the light of day. Just recently, there was a film showed up that had been locked away for years. Somebody took it, and they didn't turn it in, and then all of a sudden their family found it, and it's become public. And so I think there's a very good chance that in the future we may see more photographs and more film evidence come forward. But even the evidence we do have, like the famous Zapruder film, in my new updated version of my book, Crossfire, same title, but it's a new version with a tremendous index in it. And in there, you're going to find the evidence that even the Zapruder film has been tampered with. There are missing frames, and there are certain frames that have been doctored. I have 11 Hollywood film and video experts, all of whom have years of experience with 8mm and Super 8mm film, and some of them who have worked on films dating back into the 30s, and they all unanimously said that there are crude forgeries in the Zapruder film. And we now know beyond any question that it was in the hands of the CIA prior to being turned over to Time Life magazine. And so you can't even trust the Zapruder film as being an accurate portrayal of what happened.